Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big issues in this republic of inequality. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and we are the podcast of solutions as well. I nearly forgot to add it in. And as always, we encourage you to become a patron, sign up to support us. To keep going in this podcast, go to tortoiseshack.ie/... Patreon.com/tortoiseshack. I always forget that and mix it up, but we need you to help us out. Keep going. We're putting out all the big issues and covering them and giving the analysis, the solutions, and the hope. And today we're doing another Hanging with the Hearns, but it's a Hanging with the Hearns with a difference. I am absolutely, utterly thrilled and delighted to be joined by my sister, Kate Marie Hearn. Kate Marie, how are you?
I'm very well, Rory. How are you doing?
Good, good, good. Welcome to Reboot Republic.
Thank you. Thank you. I can't believe you convinced me to do
I know.
This.
It was, you required a bit of...
Coercion.
Coercion is the word. No, not coercion. Arm twisting or something like that to get you on. But eventually, I was hassling you for a while, but you caved eventually.
I did.
What made you cave?
Why did I cave?
Yeah.
I'm a complete people pleaser, Rory. You know me. That's... You know what though? I was thinking about this, and I was a bit triggered, and it brought me back to when we were very, very young.
And now, Kate Marie, the stories, careful with the stories now.
And we dabbled in this, remember, with the old stereo in one of the rooms at home, and we made the evening news. There was some ballad singing.
Oh my God, I do not remember that, I have to say. You'll have to explain to the younger listeners what a stereo is.
So basically, we used to have, it was on one of the older brothers' stereos. We used to have, like, you know, the double button. You press it, you press record, and we used to do, like, the news and... You're really leaving me hanging here, Rory.
No, memories are coming, are flooding back now. I'm just trying to withhold all the trauma as well. So I have to be very careful what memories I let back in, you know, so I can stay in control.
Yeah, they were happy memories for me, Rory.
That's great.
This is not a therapy session.
Okay, very clear. Very clear with that. That's good. That's good. Yes, the old tape. I do remember tape recording, all right, something or other. Did we prepare our new script or did we just go for it ad lib?
Yeah, no. And we threw in a few Irish ballads as well. Only Our Rivers Run Free and stuff like that as well. We're kind of intermingled. They were probably our jingles, you know.
Yes, yeah. That's probably not a bad idea to start the reboot, a jingle of When Only Our Rivers Run Free. I'd have to go back now and remember the words. We better not get into that, though. We could
upset a few people. I think we'll move on, yeah. Your next podcast.
With my hollering, though you have a nice voice, mine attempting to sing is very disturbing.
No comment, Rory.
No comment, yeah. Leave me hanging there. Kate, listen, I was supposed to start with, I am delighted to have you on. I suppose, firstly, to let listeners know, you're a primary school teacher and you're the parent of two beautiful, wonderful children who are aged one. And of course, I need to get this absolutely correct or I'm going to be utterly hung for not knowing my nieces and nephews' ages. But thank you for holding up the fingers and telling me Shamie's age. Evian is one and Jamie is three. Yay, hey, wonderful.
Yeah,
and
well,
I know it's your lovely husband Owen too.
Yeah.
Carrying serious amounts of pressure and weight.
That's it. So no, I'm very lucky. He is very supportive, in fairness to him. And we're very, very busy, but very lucky at the same time. And the lads keep us very much on their toes, on our toes, probably on their toes too. But but no. So all is good, Rory. Busy, as you know. I did have to laugh at you. You tweeted a while back about I think it was a full moon, and you said, I think your little one Aaron was up at 4 a.m. And I said, you are so lucky, it only happens on a full moon for you.
Evie is a bit of a night owl.
She is indeed, yes. Yeah. Apparently, so. But anyway, no, but look, she's great. And
it's not easy though, Kate, is it? It's not easy to be like, waking, what's your night like and going into work the next day?
To be honest, it kind of, you know, it depends as well. Like I'm still breastfeeding her, so like she does kind of wake a couple of times, and I suppose it's more for comfort now than anything else. But to be honest, it's kind of easier sometimes. I bring her into the bed with me, and I know people will be aghast when they hear that, but I think a lot of parents, like, you know, it's funny, anyone, like a lot of parents you talk to, and you feel like you've kind of revealed this awful, shameful thing that you bring your child into the bed with you, and then suddenly you see, like, the knowing kind of look and the nodding, and they're kind of almost, you feel the solidarity that we've all done it. But but it's funny, people can be, you know, I suppose slow to share about that sometimes. I suppose we're all so worried about, maybe I'm sure it's the same for dads as well, but definitely, like, for mammies, like, you're definitely, I don't know, isn't that, there's that pressure, isn't there? You know, sometimes, are you doing it right? You know, you feel like I'm more than likely doing it wrong, you know, but you're just doing your best, and, you know, and very lucky to be in that situation that, you know, you can provide a roof over their head, and you can feed them, and they're happy for the most part, you know.
But, yeah, of course, it does make you think straight away, like, whenever I have these discussions, and of course, you know, it is utterly exhausting for us, but we are privileged to be in a, you know, a stable home, and you think of, like, how do people do it in homeless emergency accommodation, in B&Bs and hotels?
In direct provision, absolutely. Like, it's, I just don't know. I mean, you know, you have those days, and people kind of, they use the saying, the walls are closing in, but, like, in a room, you know, if your whole family's in a room, like, that's, you know, that's, you know, our challenges are merely, like, you know, they keep us busy and on our toes, but that, you know, we're so lucky. Like, I don't know, I just think, like, that whole thing of raising a family in a B&B or in direct provision, it's, you know, there's no way of defending it, you know.
And it does make you wonder, doesn't it, that, like, you know, we live this experience, and, you know, as you know, you kind of say, and we have such, you know, joy and such, you know, amazing times with our children, but, you know, they are challenging and as well. Mm-hmm. And that is the reality, and particularly at a young age, you know, and you think, like, how people in power, you know, who have to have these experiences, well, you know, how do they dehumanize people to the point at which, you know, they don't think, you know, how can a family be raised, expected? How can children, how is it right that children developmentally, and you're an educator, do you know what I mean, as well, of young children, and, you know, and you look at all the different parts of developmentally, and it's something that I really, you know, it makes me very upset, actually, when I think about what we do to children in direct provision, in homelessness. But how do we strip away their humanity to the point at which we allow this?
I don't know. I mean, is it a lack of empathy? Is it kind of justifying decisions by saying, well, you know, I can do some right by whatever policy or whatever decision we're going to make, and sure, we can't, it'll filter down eventually. And I don't know. I mean, you'd have to completely, you know, disconnect yourself from what is the reality for people who are really struggling in those situations. And I do wonder, and I mean, you know, I could be criticized for saying this, but I do wonder, is it reflected in we'll say the way our government is made up in terms of the gender balance? Like, you look at New Zealand and Jacinda Ardern, and, like, we say, you know, one of her big things that she said was, say, when after their landslide victory, was, you know, she was showing that being emotional and having empathy is a strength. Like, showing emotion is not a weakness. And you do, I suppose, as a woman as well, and my perspective is obviously from that point, like, you know. And I know, like, you know, the main parties and stuff, they're talking about trying to balance, you know, get a better gender balance. And some people feel that, you know, quotas won't work or shouldn't be there because the right man or woman for the job and all that. But I do wonder, like, you know, is it just that imbalance in terms of our decision makers that lead us to these situations where particularly the needs of children, the needs of, we'll say, women, you'd have to say, because there's a huge number of women who end up in those situations, we'll say, of homelessness, single parent families. Is it because they're not represented? You know, is that why it's easier to make those kind of decisions? I don't know.
I think it's absolutely part of it. There's no doubt, you know, that. But we know as well that, you know, it's also the system that operates. And even with, you know, a female, you know, Taoiseach or whatever, if that female Taoiseach doesn't have a perspective of, as you said, empathy, you know, we can see ministers in the Tory government in Britain, you know, making horrendous decisions about immigrants.
Absolutely.
But I do think you're right. It's an important, really important aspect. And there's no doubt, I think that, because unfortunately, we still live in a deeply patriarchal society, unfortunately, he says. But isn't that,
you're talking about the system, but isn't that the whole point as well? That like in capitalism, you know, it is inherently patriarchal. So you can't, you know, with all the movements of you can't see it, you can't be it and all of that. But it is harder for women when you don't have proper childcare. Or, you know, you don't have kind of supports like that, that, you know, it is harder for women then to move up the ladder or, you know, to make decisions, you know, in terms of their own career and stuff like that, you know.
I'm going to ask you, the questions are flooding into my head now of what things that...
Should I be afraid? I should be very afraid.
No, not at all. No. That, you know, get your perspective on, which I think is, it's really interesting, you know, and I'm so delighted that you're doing this because, you know, we've had lots of chats down the years and, you know, I always thought you've brought a really, I suppose, a passionate, you know, perspective and one which is of a woman as well, do you know what I mean? And having that, you know, those roles and responsibilities and that perspective is really, you know, it's so valuable, I think, and we don't hear enough of it. I was going to ask you first about the experience of being a mother during COVID and during the lockdown of you know, your Evie just turned one in August. Mm-hmm. When we were lucky to get down, yeah, that's just because I remember went down the one time I was down to see the family, which has been really hard, and not seeing mom, in this time, and you know,
it's so hard, Roy, and it is. I mean, it's so hard for families that have been that haven't been able to share like all the milestones and just the small stuff. Like I noticed your daughter got Star of the Week today and, you know, not been able to, I know you can do it virtually, but it's lovely to be able to do those things, you know, in real time as well. And I think, I'm sure there are so many families, you know, that are really, really feeling that, especially with the numbers today and with the talk now, what's to come, you know, it's a really hard time. And the only thing I'd say is though, it feels like, you know, there is an end in sight as well, you know, and I suppose that's kind of, you'd be kind of hoping that will get us through as well the next few months, you know. But sorry, going back to your question, Rory, just about being a mother during lockdown. To be honest,
struck me was that what you said there about the shame of and the difficulty of speaking about, you know, bringing the child into bed or, you know, what approaches. And we've talked about this before, I mean, the challenges of, you know, being a young mother and, you know, at that early stage. And but it must have made you, or did it, you know, and not just you, but, you know, you obviously talking to other, you know, mothers and about that level of isolation and that lack of support then that you would get.
Yeah, and
I think, for example, community groups weren't meeting around baby support, mother and baby groups and those sort of things weren't meeting as well.
And I think, yeah, and I think, to be honest, your experience will be hugely influenced and obviously the circle you have around you, your partner, if you have a partner in your life as well. And also, I think what, you know, whether it's your first baby or second baby, I think I really, really felt for anyone who had their first baby with all of the joy and all of the kind of, you know, I'll never forget like the first time, you know, your siblings hold your baby or your friends hold your baby and or granny or granddad or whatever it is. And that's just huge. And it's more than, you know, it's more than just the photo op and all that. It's huge because you do feel like that you certainly need that support around you, even if it's just saying, giving you a pat on the back and saying, well done, you'll get through it, like with the nights and all that kind of stuff. That's really important. So I really felt for first time mums and dads, like just that, you know, maybe they were, you know, they definitely, I'm sure, felt that isolation. And just then, I suppose for any of the mums, like, did, you know, definitely not having those community groups, Quidju and the Letch League run breastfeeding support groups. They did try to continue those virtually, but I can imagine if it was your first time with your baby, that would have been a very, very daunting thing to do, to like go on to Zoom with your baby, like, and try and kind of you know, express how you're feeling or express how breastfeeding is going or not going or, and even with that, like, I was lucky that I'd had a positive experience first time round. So with my second baby, I mean, people say it's the most natural thing in the world, but it's still really hard at the start, whether it's your first baby or second baby. And there's loads of stuff that you're not told or is not shared with you, probably for good reason. but equally, you know, I suppose I was very lucky, like with my sisters-in-law and things like that, like they were always so supportive, and mom as well. But like if you were on your own and if you made your decision around how you wanted to feed and then you didn't have anyone to kind of, you know, to kind of say, is this normal? You know, it's very hard to go onto a Zoom with someone you've never met before and talk about something really like personal and, you know, intimate, like, you know. In saying that, it was very interesting that I think it was in the summer that some research came out that in, I think it was research from the UK, but the Irish Midwives Association shared it, that breastfeeding rates had actually improved or increased during lockdown because parents were in this bubble and were actually given time and space. So I'm kind of completely contradicting myself.
Yeah.
Here.
No. It makes sense though as well.
So for some people, that space, not having all of the visitors drop in, the space to maybe go around the house with your, you know, top off, which you have to do at the start and all that kind of stuff. Like, you know, but that space meant that women who wanted to continue, you know, were maybe able to. Whereas I suppose in normal time when you do have lots of visitors, there is this expectation that you bounce back after a few days and you're going to be down having coffee with everyone and, you know, and that doesn't work really well when you're trying to breastfeed, you know, especially first time round. So I think definitely the isolation, it was, you know, I really missed those kind of groups and I missed, you know, I missed kind of, you know, the figuring out that goes along with sharing with other parents. But at the same time, I suppose I was very lucky. Owen was at home more because he was working from home. So that was fantastic, obviously, with Jamie because he was a whirlwind toddler. So as I said, I think for first time parents, I think it must have been really, really challenging, you know.
And it's an interesting time as we, you know, as I think as we go on that, you know, I think the implications of all of this and the impacts of all of this, like particularly, you know, on mental health wise and isolation on health and all sorts of issues that, like, as I even think of developmentally, you know, children aren't getting their developmental checks, you know, in the same way that there's all these sort of crises, you know, and issues that are going to build up. And again, it's going to be the more vulnerable who are going to be affected. Just in terms of something, you know, as going back to, what the other question I was going to ask you following on from earlier, what we were talking about there, the impact on, you know, families and children, you know, living in emergency accommodation, living in direct provision. And, you know, you would have had children go through your school and in those situations. And like generally, and obviously not giving any specifics, you know, what would you see generally sort of the impacts on these children of living in those situations? Or would you kind of, would that be visible in a classroom or, you know, in that way? Or
definitely. I think it depends on the age of the child. I mean, sometimes it can be children finding it difficult. We'll say if they've grown up in kind of more of a communal space, that they find it difficult maybe to settle into the routines and the norms of a classroom because they've, you know, they haven't had maybe not because of any fault of their parents or anything like that, but just that they're going into a place where you know, they have to do certain things, and you know, they're not coming from the, I'm going to say in inverted commas, normal household where you know, you can parent the way you want. So sometimes they've been parented in a situation where maybe their parents have to, I don't know, like I struggle to be able to put words on, because I don't know how those parents manage in communal living, whether it's direct provision or B&Bs, or, you know, how do you parent? How do you give your children like boundaries and, you know, routines? So understandably, when you can't, not through any fault of a parent. Of course, it's going to be a challenge then for the child to maybe settle into whatever it is, junior infants or senior infants. The other thing then, I suppose, is I definitely think you can, in some cases, you can see issues around self-esteem and self-image, you know, and children maybe been afraid to share. Maybe, you know, this kind of, that's what their self-worth, you know, wondering that, you know, is what they have to say worthwhile, you know? I definitely think you see that, you know, there's definitely a huge issue around self-esteem and self-confidence, and therefore, you know, a reluctance at times maybe to contribute to whole class discussions.
So it definitely
No, it's just the last thing I say is certainly no lack of love. Like, you can see that, you know, they're loved and they're cared for, and, you know, but it's just, you know, as you were saying, Sarah, it's just not right though. You know, every child, you know, no child chooses the life they're born into, but like all, you know, when you talk about equality, it's just equality of opportunity. But unless you've a home, where is the equality of opportunity there in terms of what your expectations will be as a 9-year-old when your friends are talking about, you know, coming over to their house for, you know, to play their PlayStation, or, you know, do you want to play football at the back of my garden? And they can't, they can't offer that, you know?
And would you hear those conversations, you know, or how do you manage that in a classroom?
Unless a child comes to you and, you know, seeks your support in that way, you try and mind them as much as you can within the whole class setting, and, you know, you kind of give them as many opportunities as possible to see their own worth or to take pride in their own work, and to make sure that they've got a buddy if they're finding it hard to share in class, that they'd have a buddy that they could kind of build up and talk in a small group, and then maybe they'd have the you know, they grown confidence to be able to share in the class, like in the old, you know, pre-COVID. Like a lot, I do a lot of project work with my class around the Sustainable Development Goals and around the work of Irish Aid. And we kind of do lots of projects in the community. And stuff like that can be very empowering for all children, but particularly for children who wouldn't have those opportunities at home. Again, through no fault of their parents, but just because of their life circumstances and where they've ended up. So those kind of projects where they feel a connection with the community, and whether it's working with Tidy Towns, which we've done in the past, or Tomorrow Eco Group, and you can just see all the children, but particularly children who maybe haven't experienced that kind of, you know, wider network of people, like, you know, literally growing in stature in terms of how they see themselves, when like the head of the Tidy Town say, geez, you're some fella, I can't believe, you know, did you really get that full bag of rubbish? And not in a patronizing way, but
yeah.
In a really genuine way, and that kind of sense of just feeling good about yourself, you know.
No, it's really, you know, it's really interesting and so important, you know, and we need to do so much more work on it. And I do like the research I did. I remember working with the homeless families, you know, about that whole parenting thing and the challenges and the, you know, the, of course, you know, homelessness, experiencing homelessness, and obviously direct vision similarly, and you know, poverty, many cases of intense poverty is an adverse childhood experience. You know, it has major traumatic impacts. And that whole idea of parenting and how you do public parenting, and even how do you, you know, as you say, put boundaries on a child and all that is so challenging. But we might come back to that again, Kate, if you'll grace us again, so in some future time, if I don't absolutely scare you away on this one. But to move on, the issue, another issue that you wanted to talk about, that I pressured you into talking about, and I think probably in reality, what really pushed us into doing this podcast was Waterford getting hammered by
I know.
No, I actually said they were hammered, and I'm going to use that word hammered, not in the scores, but in the amount of dirty tackles by Limerick in the first 20 minutes, that they at least three of their players should have been sent off, and that is a completely unbiased perspective, with no Waterford goggles on at all.
No,
not at all. But
I think that's a very passionate and I loves me county view, definitely. But and you know me, I'm not into hurling at all, Rory.
No. Of course, as a former camogie player for Waterford County, which I really should have led the whole introduction with, being that that being the main sort of purpose of life and the main goal, and children and own and everything just come far well, fourth or fifth.
I'll tell you what, I know, and I'll tell you what, without the support of an own, as some of the girls in the Camogie team, they all wanted an own.
To give you the support to be able to do it. But yes, no, it's important to say that you played county Camogie for Waterford and represented the county, which is an amazing achievement. And it shows your level of skill and ability and tenacity and determination.
Thank you, Rory.
Yeah, no. So
is this where I say that you marked John Milan out of it in the club?
No. But that's great. Thanks for telling me that. People listening won't have a clue who John Milan is, so it doesn't matter. You'd be surprised. Yeah, I did mark him. At least I think I did. Dad said I did anyway. But
I think I did.
I do remember playing in De La Salle that day, all right, and marking this fella, this skinny, tall fella. And
he never had your pace, though, Rory.
I think my marking wasn't via pace and more via hanging on to his jersey good and tight.
Which brings us nicely back to Limerick and Waterford. I think, I know what you're saying, and it's hard not to be emotional about it. And I mean, I think you have to say, though, I mean, if you look at how the match was refereed, like Limerick, they didn't, you know, technically they didn't do anything wrong. They did what you can do within the rules. It's frustrating to watch. It's definitely, like, there's been a huge debate around whether you bring in a black card in hurling. And I think it looks like that seems to be gathering a lot of traction at the moment, you know, because I suppose it will seek to do something about the very cynical fouling that has been going on, you know. But I mean, you can't argue with, like, Limerick, not just their physicality, but their skill level is just immense. And I think a fair analysis, you know, that a lot of commentators provided as well, was like, very few teams would have lived with Limerick and the way they performed, you know, on Sunday.
Yeah.
Galway, you know, were the closest to them. And I think physically Galway are probably closest to them in that regard as well, but in terms of their physical potential as well. But
Tadhg DeBerke going off was a big loss for Waterford.
Huge loss. And this is the thing: if anyone else lost, if Hegarty or like Dahi or whoever, like, you know, went off
early in the game at that stage.
Yeah. It's realistic. Like, realistically, Waterford had, you know, an excellent season. But I know for the players, they had, you know, their expectations of themselves. Of course, they set them out, and it was, you know, to win the All-Ireland. So they won't be, I mean, they're not, I heard Liam Callan mentioning even before the All-Ireland, like, you know, they're through with moral victories. And I think that's, in a county like Waterford, no more than Mayo on Sunday, like, 61 years is too long, you know. It's, even the survivors from, but the men who are left from 1959, you know, they were kind of saying, a few of them who were interviewed before the All-Ireland, saying, like, you know, you can't keep coming back to us. It's time, you know, that they feel like it's time for there to be another team of winners. And I think there's huge potential in this Waterford team.
Yeah.
I think Lee Fahill and Mikey Beavens and Stephen Frampton, I think they've shown that they're extremely astute. And, like, what they did in a few months, given that we locked down everything, like, you know, I'd be very hopeful about what they could do in a year.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think I'd be very hopeful as well. And they definitely showed a lot of skill. And I was completely convinced they were going to win before Sunday.
We all were, Rory.
We all were.
But we all got excited.
Huh? We all got very excited. And it was wonderful, you know. And thank you to the team for giving.
And it really, do you know what? It's true. And it's been lovely. There's been a huge outpouring of gratitude to the players and the management, which has been really, really nice. Because at times, you know, things can get negative down here when there isn't the success that we think is coming, you know. But no, they lifted the whole county. And there was a real, you know, it kind of, as I said, it was a real lift for everybody, I think, in the county.
And following on then, the other, which was actually the real reason why we said we better do this podcast and it spurred into action, would of course, the whole issue of women and GAA and gender in sport, and something that's very, very close to heart and to your heart, my heart. And obviously having two, you know, a sister that I, you know, supported, I hoped as much as I did in
You went to plenty of All-Ireland semi-finals and Munster finals and in the back.
No, I was more thinking when you were 3 years of tackling you as hard as I could.
That too.
I've lost my train of thought now.
It is.
You remind me, this is either exhaustion from children or what?
Or old age, Rory. One of the old age.
I'd say that's probably what it is.
No, but I was going to say it has been positive. Yeah. It has been a very positive week in that regard, I would say. I'm not sure if you heard, you probably did, but that the Women's Gaelic Players Association and the Gaelic Players Association have voted to merge and become one players association.
Yes. So I heard that. Yeah.
Instead of the Women's Gaelic Players, I think it'll just be the GPA. I'm not 100% sure whether they're going to change their title. But that represents over 4,000 county players. And I think what was most striking about that was the vote from the GPA, so the male body, it was 100% voted in favour. And I just think, like, it's basically like the whole point of the GPA initially was it was like a player's body for players. Because, you know, I do think in the next few years as well, it is going to come up in terms of the demands on players, both male and female, and whether, like, we know it's amateur, but we also know that the demands are akin to professionalism. So I think there are going to be huge issues around player welfare and stuff over the next few years and just where we're going. But that's a different conversation. But I think it's really, really significant because the funding was, as you can imagine, with a lot of women's sports and women's organizations, like the WGPA got significantly less. Now it will all be one organization. So there's, Paul Flynn talking about it, the guy from Dublin, just saying, that they will seek to address that, like, straight away, that they'll be changing their national executive to represent, we'll say, be more gender balanced. They've already been working together, but that now, I suppose, structurally, they're going to have the same objectives, and gender will be a huge one of their objectives as well going forward. The promotion of the female game, but also parity in terms of financial supports for female athletes and county players. Because there was a few studies done, and basically, I think it was something like between 80 and 90% of female county players, you know, pay like all of their own travel expenses. They get nothing in terms of travel expenses. So the top elite, maybe the top two to four Camogie teams, the top 2 to 4 senior ladies Gaelic football teams, maybe there's some bit of financing there, but like for everybody else, it's all out of their own pocket. Physio, the same. And it's hard to believe we're still talking about this, because this is the way it was when I was playing. And like it's 10 years ago this year since we won All-Ireland. Like that was the first adult team in Waterford to win All-Ireland. And back then, like we felt really privileged because we had Mark Cooney, and Mark Cooney went on to look after to be involved with the Waterford hurling team. The year before, we had Andy Maloney, who played hurling for Waterford, and he's now actually involved in Galtier Camogie, with Niall Dunphy and loads of really, really good people involved. And we felt that we had a really, professional approach to what we were doing, and I think that's why we did as well as we did. But what I'm trying to get to in a very roundabout way is basically it's hard to believe that back then, of course, we didn't get expenses. It's 10 years ago, but like, you know, the same players who are probably even giving more time now, you know, at senior county level, they're still paying for it out of their own pocket. And you know, it's all well and good to love your county, like, but you know, there comes a point where if your demands, whether it's, you know, you still have to get the bus to college. You still, if you're in college, you still have to, you know, go to your day job. That, you know, and then of course you have the issue with where the Cork and Dublin footballers, you know, there was a change of venue on the morning of the match because the Limerick hurlers needed the training ground. Now, on the one hand, you could kind of, you know, you could feel very annoyed at the Limerick County Board, but in fairness to them, it was the Ladies Gaelic Football Association that agreed the venue, we'll say, right? Knowing that if Limerick progressed to an All Ireland final, that they automatically would have their training grounds.
Yeah.
So Limerick County Board said, no problem, you can use the sports ground in Limerick, no problem. But you know, if we get to an All Ireland, our hurlers, you know, will take priority. And Ladies Gaelic Football said, yeah, that's no problem. You know, so
Does it overall signify that, you know, we've changed a lot as society, but in many ways we haven't. And that, you know, even at start, like, you know, with a GA and the GA is so central, you know, to Irish society, that there's still a fundamental, you know, huge gender inequality, that women's sport is not treated with parity. And how does that make you feel? Like, how does that make you feel, you know, as a young woman, as a woman growing up playing sport, that you're, you know, your sport, it's not given the same priority, not given the same level of importance as the men's game?
Yeah, of course. Like, you, I think, Rory, though, like, for what my hope is that for the next generation, things have changed and their expectations of themselves have also changed. For me, like, I mean, I was very lucky. I was surrounded by four brothers and my dad. And, like, to me, I didn't see any gender difference in my family growing up, and particularly around hurling camogie. So, like, I never felt that as such. And I also think, you know, you're growing up in an environment and in a society that's conditioning you all the way as you go. So it was no, you know, you didn't expect it. You didn't expect crowds at your games. It was almost like you always knew that it would be like the staunch, just core family members and, you know, friends maybe came to a county final type thing,
yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But you're conditioned, you know, it's the norm. So it's not, I suppose, when we got to an All Ireland final as well, like, you know, playing in Croke Park, like, and we ended up playing, like, it was the third time around that we ended up, that we won, like, so we were there a few times, but, like, you know, I suppose that was fantastic to play in, but it was practically empty, you know?
Yeah.
But at the same time, you're kind of so, when you're in that space, you're so in your own bubble in terms of the team and stuff, that stuff isn't important. Maybe looking back now, you might go, I suppose it would have been nice if there's a bigger crowd, and you look at the hurling and, of course, like, this huge crowds and stuff.
Yeah.
But I suppose now what I'm saying is that if you're conditioned to not expect any different, it stops getting in on you. And maybe that's a worrying thing.
Yeah. That conditioning, and of course we know that happens across society with women and their roles,
everything, yeah.
And everything that conditioning. And I suppose that's the importance of women then standing up, and men in solidarity, in challenging, yeah, and changing that culture, yeah, and that conditioning.
And I have to say, in terms of my own club in Tramore, so we're a senior camogie team, a senior camogie club, and the men have intermediate football and now intermediate hurling after winning the junior this year. But, like, we in Tramore GA, it's run as it's called the one club model. So basically, it's one club and four codes instead of camogie, ladies Gaelic football, hurling. And the idea is that, you know, I suppose it's the model that the GA are hoping to, or are talking about adopting going forward, if there's a merger of the Ladies Gaelic Football Association and the Camogie Association. Because the era of having sister associations just doesn't work, because in that zone you're depending on the GA to, you know, out of courtesy, give you a pitch. And that just can't work anymore, because, you know, camogie players and footballers are given too much of their time. And so I think in Tramore, like, you know, it's been, I feel it's a really positive setup. And, like, certainly at any of our matches when we did have crowds, all the hurlers were always there at our matches and were hugely supportive in a really sincere and genuine way, you know. And then in terms of the underage, like, we've huge numbers of girls and boys playing together, you know. But it does feel like there's, I'm sure, look, nothing is perfect, and I'm sure there's ways that it can be improved and all of that. But it just feels like that would be a model that would work well, because then you've got, you've got young girls in a situation where they do expect equality, just in terms of opportunity, you know, going forward within their own club, that they're not, that their role isn't sidelined, you know?
Yeah, yeah. It's a model that could be expanded across society.
It is. And we talk an awful lot about the GA, as you know, when we end up getting together. But I think, like anything, I mean, it's a grassroots organization, and there is something very, very special about the GA in Ireland, you know, historically, culturally. And I think that there's no doubt that it's, you know, it's why we're so passionate about our clubs and our counties, because it's how we see ourselves as well. And it's our sense of identity, you know. So if you have these grassroots organizations, these clubs promoting real gender equality, and not just promoting it, but actually allowing girls and boys to live it. Like this year, for example, it was incredible because of COVID, there were actually some positives, because all of the underage county finals were live streamed. So the under 12 girls county final was live streamed, under 14 girls, and Tramore actually won the under 14 A county final this year. And all of their peers and classmates were able to watch, you know, and it was, you know, there was hugely positive feedback from, you know, from their male counterparts, you know. And I just think it's really good. If you can't see it, you can't be it. And I hope, like, going forward, that even beyond COVID, that live streaming is something. I know everything has to be paid for, but it's definitely, it's something, you know, that is fantastic in terms of allowing girls see, you know, other girls playing, and women, because obviously the huge drop-off rate in female sports is a huge challenge, I think.
Yeah, no, it is. And it's something that, you know, I hope you keep raising, and I hope you keep nurturing. And because obviously with two daughters myself as well, who, you know, are engaging, well, obviously Erin, her at a year old, her only sport is driving me bananas. But chasing the cat around the room. But, you know, Aisling is playing her sports, and I definitely think it is. It's so important that, you know, that parity, that equality, and that nurturing of the expectation, you know, is there from the start. But listen, Kate, unfortunately, time is not on our side, and we have to finish up. Would you believe it? One last one to kind of expand it out. You're kind of, you know, because we've talked, like, at a broad level, like really broad level, macro level, about politics and change and the need to change society. You know, do you feel that, you know, the Ireland we live in today is one that needs significant change? And what are the big changes that you think are needed? Just to really throw it at you. Gee, you only have to name, like, you know, seven or eight.
Jeez, Rory, where I think a huge, you know, it's investment in public services for me, and in what's important to people, which is providing homes for people. And I think, like, you look at, it's Finland, isn't it? Like the kind of, I know someone else was using the homes first phrase.
Yes,
there.
Yes, Finland is actually, yeah.
Yeah, but did they actually say that before you can do anything, you've got to give people a home, before you even address addiction issues or kind of any kind of mental health issues, you have to provide a home. And within that, people can heal or can recover or can, you know, build a life for themselves and their families and, you know, look for work. I think that's fundamental. So, like, you'd be hoping that, like, a right to housing would be enshrined in the constitution. And I'm not just saying that because obviously your background, but, you know, it is. You can, you know, but you genuinely, you can see it from an educationist point of view as well, because you see the effects of it at a very young age as well. Obviously, investment in education is fundamental. And I think, like, reducing our class sizes, you know, COVID aside, you know, I think it really, I suppose because of COVID, a real kind of focus was put on, our spotlight was put on the size of our classes. You know, they've got to be reduced. They just have to. You do the best you can. And we have fantastic teachers in this country. But, you know, to be able to meet the needs properly of all children, and particularly of children with special needs, when we're moving towards this inclusion model, you know, you've got to reduce class sizes and make sure that there are enough supports, whether it's special needs assistants or resource teachers there to make sure that children get, you know, the education that they deserve, and to ensure that they actually have the skills to be able to be competent and confident citizens, you know, and to feel like that they, you know, they matter. Like, if you don't educate, if you don't invest in education, like, you know, the message to children really is, you know, well, it's just something you do. You go through the system, as opposed to the reason we're investing all this in you is because you matter. You're going to be the future. You are the future, and you're going to be the global citizens, and you are going to be the ones to maybe make the changes that we, you know, and say we weren't ballsy enough to do or whatever, like, you know, but, and you see it all the time. And I would say there's a lot of negativity around, but I suppose we're, as a teacher, I feel really, really privileged that every day I go into a room of 30 children and there's just hope, like, just hope, because you see, they don't have all the baggage that we have, and they just see things very black and white, and they can see, you know, injustice for what it is, and they have no problem. They will call it out straight away, and they're completely solution focused as well. And it'd be great, you know, it was excellent listening to Leo recently, and I think maybe that's an absence. There's a real absence of, like, young voices.
They just, you know? Clarify, you mean Leo, my son, not Leo Varadkar.
No, I'm talking about Leo Varadkar, your body.
Oh, sorry, apologies. Sorry, Jesus.
Yeah, no, and I thought that was really good to kind of, you know, as I said, like, just because what they have to say and what they can do is just incredible. They surprise me all the time in a good way, you know.
Well, Kate Marie, I have to say this has turned out really, really well. I'm not remotely surprised, and a lot of people will be very, very surprised to hear that this is your first ever podcast, your first ever.
Oh, are you recording this?
Oh, very good, Kate. Very good. This is your first ever media interview outside of talking about the All Ireland final 10 years ago on WLR. That is incredible. I have to say, you know, you've really been inspiring and interesting, engaging. I think the listeners will really, really like it.
Okay. Well, thank you, Rory.
There. Great to have you on.
To all.
Happy Christmas to all, indeed. And how's mom anyway?
Great. Yeah, flying form. She's asked for binoculars and a table tennis table for Christmas.
Of Santa Claus.
Of Santa Claus. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, listen, thanks.
You're on. Don't worry.
Thanks for looking after her. It's tough not being able to see her, but we'll see her over, hopefully, in the new year.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, listen, Kate, thanks so much. And listen, it's been really, really good. And hopefully you might come back. How did you find it?
Yeah. No, it was a fun way to pass a Friday evening in lockdown.
And not a drink in sight?
No. I will have a glass of wine now, though.
Yes, indeed.
I might have earned it.
You absolutely have. You are. No, I really do. I think your passion and commitment is really, really admirable. And you're a real role model. So I think Tony, the producer, thought Leo was you know, really just like was going to wiped my me. You know, he wiped the floor with me. That, you know, people were going to, God, who's this fella? Leo will take over. And now when they hear you, they'll be like, Rory, get out of it. Leave her to take control.
I know. You see, this is actually an intervention, Rory, to remove you from the airwaves.
This is the coup I didn't know about.
Yeah. Finally okay. Happening.
You're great. I'm delighted to hear. Well, listen, thanks so much, Kate, for joining us. And we'll talk to you soon, Kate.
All right. All the best.
Okay. And listen, as always, thank you very much, listeners, for keeping supporting us on Patreon. You are being great, and we know you're enjoying it, and it is lovely to have you on the journey with us, listening, engaging with the issues, bringing your passion and our passion to changing this country to make it a republic of equality, and indeed a world where we have social justice and environmental justice, and everybody gets the opportunity to live the life, the opportunity and the reality to live the life that they deserve, and with dignity. So thank you very much. And this could be the last one of 2020. I'm not sure. But if it is, happy Christmas, happy New Year, have a lovely break, take care. And we'll talk to you soon. And don't forget, if you can support us, go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Talk to you all soon. Thank you.